Hey folks, thank you so much for tuning in. In this episode, I speak with Hilary Moore. Hilary is the author of the booklet, Burning Earth, Changing Europe, How the Racist Right Exploits the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And she's also the co-author of No Fascist USA, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, and Lessons for Today's Movement. In her booklet, Burning Earth, Changing Europe, she examines how right-wing ideology in all its various forms, various manifestations, reacts to, co-opts, and inserts its agendas into the discourse and activism surrounding climate change and environmentalism at large. And there are three major points that she raises in her booklet, and I ask her about these points as well in this interview. The first being, climate change is not an inherently progressive issue. The second is, how you think and talk about climate change may prop up racist right-wing positions. And number three, the far right does not need to govern to influence. I ask her to unpack each of these points in this interview. I think, just like I've done in previous interviews that deal with the subject of how the right wing discusses climate change, how it acts around climate change, I think we need to really focus on how we frame the crisis of climate change and the crisis of environmental collapse, that there is a very real political dimension to this. And what I mean by that, and that should be very obvious, right? But just like the first point there, climate change is not an inherently progressive issue, which is to say that just by talking about climate change, discussing the issues that surround it, it is not a given that people are going to take up a progressive or a leftist position on this subject. So that is why it's incredibly important that when we engage in any kind of climate activism, environmental activism, that we do not provide space for right-wing rhetoric, right-wing framing, and right-wing co-opting to occur. And this matters across the world. I mean, this is something that is applicable in many different contexts, but I would say this booklet applies specifically to Europe, but this is applicable to the United States as well. It's incredibly important that we understand how the right-wing co-opts these messages. And when we talk about the far right in particular and fascists, they're not really necessarily in denial of climate change at all. So for us as leftists or progressives or whatever you want to call yourself, for us to just assume that the right wing doesn't accept the science and won't ever accept the science, I think it's a disservice. It's something that's going to bite us in the ass if it already hasn't already. Because for instance, when we get into subjects around mass migration, relating to climate disruption or overpopulation, the subject of overpopulation, we have to approach it from a very systemic analysis, which is to say that when you have mass migration, you have whole groups of human beings that are fleeing, say, for instance, in the US, we have people coming in from South and Central America. In Europe, they have people coming in from the Middle East or from Africa. We need to understand the lasting impacts of colonialism, as well as how global capitalism is impacting these regions and how the climate crisis is visiting these regions in a far more severe and pronounced way versus how it is, say, manifesting in much of what we would call the first world or the global north, right? So we need to be very careful and mindful of how these subjects are approached. It's very much worth considering how the right wing tends to co-opt these messages to serve their own agendas. And again, because things are so serious right now, things are really coming to a head environmentally and in the climate and politically and socially and economically as well. I mean, we really don't have any time to really mess around with this anymore. We have to be very, very mindful of how we approach these subjects in our activism. So Hilary does a great job of unpacking all of that, explaining all of that. And in the latter part of this interview, I ask her to discuss the book that she also published this year that she co-authored with James Tracy, No Fascist USA, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee, and Lessons for Today's Movements. I didn't really know anything about the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. It's a really important book, and it examines something that I think, particularly for white people and how we engage with anti-racism, how we embody anti-racism in our activism and in our work. I think we can learn a lot of lessons from the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. It's something that really hasn't been written about or explored as much as it should. So I'm really glad that James and Hillary wrote this book and that she's able to discuss it towards the end of this interview. I just want to say one last thing, which is to address the major point here with climate activism and environmental activism. We have to make sure that social justice is an integral and central part of how we approach climate change, whether it's about mitigating climate change, reducing its impacts, adapting to it, you know, whatever position you have on how to grapple with this subject and engage in action around it, making sure that we have a systemic analysis of the issue and making sure that people and also non-human life and their well-being is central to this, that we do not prop up hierarchies, whether that's patriarchy, capitalism, you know, white supremacy, all of these things. I mean, the whole point is to really point to these systems as being a really important reason why these crises exist to begin with. All these things are interrelated and interconnected. So we have to remember that when we do our work. So I just want to make that final point. Hillary explains this very, very well in this interview. So I really thank her for her work, and I really thank her for taking time to speak with me. If you want to learn more about her work, I would suggest you go to her website, hillaryamoore.com. I'll put a link to that in the description. I will also be putting a link to her booklet, Burning Earth, Changing Europe. You can actually download that for free as a PDF. And also her book that she co-authored, No Fascist USA. I'll be putting a link to that in the description as well. And if you want to learn about my work specifically, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you want to support this work monetarily, there's a couple ways to do that. You can do that through a one-time donation through PayPal. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or if you want to support this work on a monthly basis, you can do that through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you contribute there, you'll get early access to these interviews before the official public release. And that's it. Without any further delay, here is my interview with Hillary Moore. I was talking to someone. I had an interview with a journalist. He's an American, but he lives in London right now. And we were just talking about how, you know, the U.S. passports are useless right now. Like, you can't really go anywhere outside the U.S. anymore. It's just, everything is just changing really quickly. But I guess it's, you know, if people have been paying attention, which I assume, you know, you have, that this has kind of been brewing under the surface, so to speak, for a long time. So it's just kind of coming to the forefront now, with all the protests and the reaction from the Trump administration and how the pandemic is playing out and how completely it's not even that they're not prepared. It's just a lack of interest in even doing anything about it, you know?
The political will is not there.
Yeah. And it feels like, I mean, we're at a point, maybe I'll just include this if you want to just start.
Cool.
I really think that the Trump, I mean, I was always just thinking maybe they're just really incompetent and there's that sense of just cynicism there. But I really think that they want to kill us. I mean, there's a real sense that there's this feeling like they really want us to die. I don't know. It's really, and I think especially being a white person, you know, the feelings that I'm feeling, I'm like, oh, I'm probably just feeling what other people have been feeling for a very long time. It's just now being extended to the rest of the population.
Right.
You know, like with these protests, what's so shocking is they're seeing, like, you know, white protesters getting beaten half to death, and they're like, oh my God, this is terrible. And I'm like, well, you know, talk to a black person who's experienced this for a very long time, or indigenous peoples, you know?
Right.
So,
not a surprise.
Yeah. I just have to kind of remember that. Keep that in mind when I talk about it. But anyway, thank you for doing this, Hillary. I appreciate it. It's a great way to start.
You're
this.
Welcome.
you know, Shane connected us together, and I've interviewed Shane quite a few times on this podcast, and I've met him in person a couple times, and then I was reading this. I mean, do you call it a pamphlet? Is that the right word for this?
Depends where you are.
Yeah, because it's...
If you call it, depending on the country and the context, it's a different word. I call it a booklet.
Booklet, okay. Because I'm like...
A small book, yeah.
Pamphlet just sounds like something you get at a doctor's office. You know, it's like right? 5 pages. And one I'm like, page, this is yeah. more than that. It's a little more robust, but it's not big enough to be like an actual book. But it's a booklet. Yeah, that's a good word for it. And yeah. the title of that, and it's a free thing you can download as a PDF. It was published through... I'm going to say this wrong. Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung. Say that again.
Stiftung.
Yeah. I can't. I'm not...
It means foundation.
Foundation.
Rosa Luxemburg Foundation.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. All right. Yeah. And that was just published this year. And the title of that is Burning Earth, Changing Europe, How the Racist Right Exploits the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And it's great. I mean, it's very much focused around the European context of climate activism, far-right populism, and the political parties that make up various European nations, like the parliamentary politics of these nations. But there's just some really good reality checks in this. So it applies to anyone that's engaging in environmental activism, climate activism, climate justice movements, and it intersects with social justice. And it's really good in that it explains what the right wing and all of its various iterations does to potentially, you know, you break it down really well. Like there is a lot of denialism in that, but there's also quite a bit of acceptance of the reality of climate change in that as well. Right. So I mean, there's this really, towards the beginning of this, there's the three things that you break down and, you explain it very well, but I'll ask you one by one, if you could break it down for us. These three things every climate activist needs to know. So the first one is climate change is not an inherently progressive issue. The second is how you think and talk about climate change may prop up racist right-wing positions. And the third is the far right does not need to govern to influence. So I would just ask with that first point, if you could explain that. Climate change is not an inherently progressive issue. What mm-hmm. does that mean?
Yeah, like you said, the booklet is really oriented towards being accessible, and who it's written for and oriented to is kind of anybody who's in motion or action around environmental or climate issues, ideally in groups and who are thinking about this collectively. And mm-hmm. especially that first point being like climate is not an inherently progressive issue. I think anybody who is my age, which is 35 or even younger, has grown up in a political milieu where, you know, climate is generally understood as a liberal thing, a left thing, something that mm-hmm. like we got and is ours. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the 80s or the 70s, that can be a very different reality and choppy waters. And then if you continue to go back in the decades. So I feel like this point is both simultaneously shocking for anybody my age and younger, and a really important political point is that the politics of the environment or nature can swing left and right depending on the conditions and who's shaping the narrative. Mm-hmm. So when we say that, it's like green politics, as we kind of generally refer to them, at different moments in time have really been far right and sometimes even fascist issues. Mm. How we conceive of nature and how we interpret nature, right? We're projecting all of our, you know, talk about it in the booklet, but like our aspirations, our values, what we want a good society to look like, all of that really comes out when nature can't speak for itself, right? Like we get to defend or protect or embolden nature to become a political issue. And so if we kind of just accept the fact, like, it's not a given, you got to fucking fight for it. If you want to keep climate and the environment a progressive issue or even a left issue, we have to get more skilled. We have to get more refined with our messaging, our campaigns, and take the political risk to declare that positive future and say what we mean by it and be very explicit in our politics, especially around justice. And the more we get kind of like flimsy on that, or perhaps, you know, for those of us who are on the newer side to the political climate game, Maybe we just don't know yet, right? Like, mm-hmm. what are the different forces that get to shape the conversation and shape the politic? So the booklet is very much trying to be a bit of a toolkit and being like, have these conversations before we meet them.
Right.
Around what are our politics, so it doesn't get taken away, so it doesn't get co-opted, so it doesn't prop up something that we didn't mean for it to happen.
Mm, right. Well, do you think that the right in general, because I feel like the roots of, say, conservationism and environmentalism does have, mm-hmm. it's very complicated, and I've covered this a bit. There is, like in the U.S. With the history of national parks and all of right. this, there is this like kind of colonialist, settler yes. colonialist and racist history to that. I think just recently the Sierra Club like formally apologized for its associations with John Muir and his racist, yeah. his racism and the roots of that organization and environmentalism, particularly in the United States. But so I do think that, you know, I think that there is this sort of recognition of those roots. But I guess my question though is, I know as climate change gets worse and worse, and it is, it's really starting to, it's not this theoretical future tense okay. thing. It's a very present thing now. So do you feel that the right wing and how it's approached climate change is one of those things where it's like the more progressive, liberal, or leftist approaches have been much more in an anticipation of climate change mm-hmm. versus the right wing, which is more of a reactionary force, as in, now it has to address climate change because immigrants are crossing their borders of these various nations, and other things are starting to impact people more directly in these nations relating to climate disruption. So I guess my question is, do you sense that the right wing only talks about climate change when it's like really imperative for them to do that?
Yes and no. Right. There's tons of different examples. And sure. even what you talked about, like when we say right, okay, is that more conservative? Is that, you know, in the European context, liberal means something here? Are they in parliament? Are they out of parliament? Are they a think tank? Are they a grassroots, you know, organizing group? You know, all of these different kinds of formations. And the booklet kind of pulls on a report by the Adelphi group that only looked at right-wing populist parties within Europe. So there's like some concrete data on like, what do they mean when they talk about climate policies? Mm-hmm. And so the booklet kind of breaks down like, okay, there's a public front, which is your platform, your policies, you know, then there's more of like the internal politics, but then there's ideologies underneath that. And so there's quite a web of different right or rightist groups having different kinds of relationships to the environment and climate. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, especially in Europe, especially in Germany, there's quite a long history of more fascist-oriented groups, more neo-Nazi groups who do have a longer history with genuine concerns about the environment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the world that I want to be moving towards by any means, but there is a orientation and a care around organizing like a healthier environment. For whom is the question, and how is the big question. But so there's different kinds of groups who hold genuine commitments to ecology. And then there's a lot of other kinds of commitments that are much more flimsy to ecology. And like you just referenced, you know, with different moments of immigration and different moments of more right-leaning governments, and how borders get framed as then something to maintain and protect ecology, mm-hmm. something to maintain and protect the environment. Like in France, you know, I forget the person's name, but a politician was talking about how borders are the best way to protect like France's countryside and mm-hmm. Ecology of France. And I think that is the same different way of talking about it.
Good to hear some European sirens in the background. It's good.
Exactly.
Adds to the ambience of this discussion. Awesome.
Yeah. Just to the point of like, there's lots of different kinds of relationships. And I think what I want to pull out and what the booklet references is, like, we are, especially in the time of COVID, in reactionary times, right? Like, mm-hmm. decisions being made, emergency measures being taken, for instance, in Europe to shut down borders, you know, like, a mm-hmm. lot got moved and is moving, and there's still a lot to be revealed about what the consequences of that are. Mm-hmm. And climate very much can be a reactionary piece for those who haven't thought through these politics ahead of time, who are just coming to, like, oh, I can't get my strawberries. Like, what the fuck, you know?
Yeah, right.
Those who have been more buffered in the crisis and who have not been listening and paying attention to climate justice movements for the past 3-4 decades.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me get to the second point, because there's these three things every climate activist needs to know. I want to go through each of these, but
sure.
You know, how you think and talk about climate change may prop up racist right-wing positions. I think in particular, two things that come up is you just mentioned the subject around borders and migration, but also, my other point left me, but there's several points here with climate change in particular, where we can really sense and understand that the right wing can easily latch onto those subjects and sort of co-opt the climate discussion, the climate activism. So yeah, if you could talk about that a bit, and how the right wing, how we need to be careful and how we frame narratives. Oh, the other thing was population control. That was another thing, kind of a Malthusian perspective on overpopulation and all of this. If you could discuss that a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, the missteps or the tricky pieces that all the climate, like, the mm-hmm. point for a climate activist needs to know is, like, yeah, we talked about environmental protection, right? Which at its core is a big part of environmental and climate campaigns usually. Mm-hmm. And then where the slip happens, or where it gets racist or xenophobic rather quickly, is when the who or how becomes a certain marginalized group, right? So particularly in Europe, you know, borders are protecting our environment because immigrants are coming, people migrating are coming and destroying our environment, maybe going to pollute this or increase, you know, pollution that. There's lots of different ways that it comes up. But when a group of people become the cause for, is the threat, and then our environment is what we are protecting. Like, there's liberal forms of that. There's, like, shitty conservative forms of that. And of course there's, like, super racist and fascist forms of that, of, like, who gets to belong on which soil, mm-hmm. and then why that happens. So environmental protection is one of, like, those slippery rocks that if we put too much weight on, we can just really slip into something that maybe we didn't mean, or maybe, you know, props up something that we don't even have awareness around. Mm-hmm. And like you said, overpopulation is the next important one. And this argument, like, has its own, it comes up, it's come up almost in every decade in different kinds of ways, but at its core, right, is an emphasis on resources and limited resources and who gets to use them and how they use them. And very quickly it turns into, like, evoking racist notions of Darwinism and survival of the fittest. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've even heard leftists kind of toss around, like, well, let the crisis come, you know, if it gets really shitty, then we can make some change happen. But if we actually think through that logic a bit more, how that happens, when you let the crisis come, those who are already most vulnerable will be the ones to die first. And in a racist, capitalist, colonialist society, patriarchal society, that's very particular about who's going to die. And then, of course, you know, more fascist interpretations of that, which were particular to the Green Wing and Nazi Germany, is life that's unworthy of life, like deciding who dies.
Yeah.
Saying, like, you can stay, we're not going to fight for you. So that's a very, again, slippery rock that goes into some fucked up stuff that we definitely want to caution against and guard against, but make sure we don't end up there and, like, caught off guard.
Right. Yeah, something that I've observed in some of the circles around climate change and environmental activism or just concerns about any of these things is, I feel like one of the first kind of reactions that I tend to observe when people become aware of how bad it really is ecologically and climatologically on the planet is like they tend to extend the shittiness of, say, industrial societies and how they've treated the environment to everything and everybody. So it's like humanity itself is shit and a virus and a plague and needs to, you know, in the earth would be better without all of us. And I know they're not necessarily talking about any particular group of people, but I became aware that the reason why I felt so uncomfortable with that framing and that narrative is I think it opens up space for right-wing narratives to come in. It's too easy for them to just come in and say, yeah, well, you're right. And there's a particular group of people that are threatening or are more responsible for that. And I've always just felt like there's all of these openings that what I would consider maybe more leftist or liberal-minded folks, they don't realize what they're doing. They don't realize what they're really giving space for. And I think we have to really push back against that. And as you address in this booklet, you know, we have to really be savvy about that, right?
Exactly. Even in Germany, the right-wing populist party who has quite a lot of influence in Eastern German states, one of their most influential politicians continues now to talk about overpopulation, in particular about birth rates in Africa and why it would be ecologically smart for us to close our borders and keep people from Africa coming to Germany. So it's not as if it's far away. These ideas are very much, even in mainstream, like, yes, a lot of people know that the AFD is total shit, but at the same time, these ideas get normalized and they get even, I hate to say it, but like in some of the more leftist or anarchist organizing circles that I was a part of in my California days, you know, it was like cool or sexy to like want the collapse to come. And to me, it's kind of like, oh, that means that to me, that's a reflection of not having a lot of relationship to movements fighting for justice.
Right.
You know, where those conversations become, it becomes very clear how racist that shit is. Versus like, oh yeah, collapse is romantic and we should welcome it and encourage it. It's like, nope, that's not what's happening here. That's not how change happens.
Do you think though there can be a balance there of acknowledging that collapse is this like inevitable process in a society like the U.S.? I personally believe the U.S. is experiencing a collapse and the rise of fascism and authoritarianism and right-wing populism and all of this in the U.S. In particular is indicative of a collapsing society, or at least a society that's facing very deep crises. That we can hold the space for understanding that this is an inevitable process, but also not wanting it to happen in that sort of romanticized, idealistic way, where we understand like this isn't something to be celebrating. This is something that we just have to take stock of and then prepare for, and still have our focus attention to the most vulnerable populations during this process. Do you know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. And to that, I would just add, like, it's a collapse of a belief in a structure of that was normal or okay for some people. Mm-hmm. And then what has been happening, especially since forever, but really like Trump's election, these uprisings, right? The veil just keeps getting unveiled or peeled back. And exactly what you're saying is like, can we keep an eye on the folks that are most vulnerable, but actually also literally organize our organizations, our campaigns, even our lives around their demands and their visions? Like, there are paths forward. There is a declared, you know, other side of transition where justice can exist. And, you know, people have been talking about real solutions for a long time. So, yes, welcoming that change as in like it's a much needed change. And then let's get a lot more skilled on making sure that we can actually weather that change and looking to the movements who have been talking about that shit for a long time.
Yeah. Well, the third point in the three things every climate activist needs to know is the far right does not need to govern to influence.
Nope.
What ways does the far right, because again, I want to really point and highlight to the political system in the United States is different from the European political systems in that here we have just two political parties. And I would argue that, you know, both are fairly right wing, just one maybe slightly more than the other at this point. But I mean, they're really quite far right at this point, the Republican Party in particular. But in Europe, it's not that cut and dry. There's quite a there's quite a variety of political parties. So there is a context there. But anyway, I would just ask, you know, in maybe both contexts, but maybe where you're at in Germany and in Europe, how does the far right influence the discussion around climate activism, even when they're not in a position of being in the parliament or in the government of these countries?
Absolutely. Yeah. One thing that I tried to bring out in the booklet is it really matters where you are, right? Like if you are in Hungary and also in Poland in various ways, like the leading party, the ruling party, and the opposition party are quite far right parties. Mm-hmm. So like that is the general milieu and more progressive or even liberal or left organizations and movements are in a much different position. Whereas in Germany, right, like AfD does have influence in some states, and in general, there's a, you know, unspoken but well-known agreement amongst parties, like we will not build coalitions with you. Mm-hmm. For various reasons. So, I mean, it's quite mixed wherever you go. But what I like to point out in the UK is that UKIP, which was now mostly a defunct parliamentary party, but Nigel Farage a few years ago was a big part of bringing climate denialism back into parliamentary politics. So they weren't even in parliament. They were gathering political attention. They were pushing from the outside and kind of like declaring what they wanted for a more nationalist agenda inside parliament. And they didn't have a lot of political influence, and their actual ability to participate in parliament was kind of been on the decline for a long time, but they raised issues and they stoked enough conversations and agitations and lots of anger around, you know, like border protections and nativism, basically, that then propelled the conversation. Like people who were then in parliament were forced to take on these more far right ideas about the government, or not the government, but climate and like positions on climate. So I say that to emphasize that, you know, you don't have to be even in the ruling coalition. Like you could be in parliament, you could be outside of parliament, or in the German context, right? There's a think tank called ICA. So they are not even a political, you know, practicing party in that way, but they have a lot of connections to different politicians in the AfD, in the CDU, in different parties actually. And their whole agenda is to produce enough denialism to support basically, you know, a reliance on the auto industry, but also undermining climate science and undermining people who are very proactive around climate. So, you know, it could be think tanks, it could be parties who don't have a lot of influence. There's quite a few different ways in which influence can happen. Mm-hmm. And it also depends on the political moment. You know, after the Eurobarometer survey came out in 2019, and it was shown like across Europe very widely, also in countries that, you know, are not typically known for like climate support, like Poland's so coal oriented. It actually showed that, you know, people who were willing to participate in the survey, you know, up in the 90s, 90% were populations in these countries. Like interest and desire for the government or for the nation to do something about climate has kept rising over the last years. And so what this indicates, right, is like kind of across the board, European society cares about climate in a way that is growing, and people are trying to take action or make sense of it in their everyday lives. And at the same time, there's more far-right and right-wing populist politicians in parliament. So with these two pieces, as well as like all these student movements, Fridays for Future, Extinction Rebellion, you know, mass actions, these pieces together, it seems like climate and environment, like a plausible guess is that this will be continued to be like a galvanizing issue. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be really aware of how these different influences take place at different levels.
Yeah. You know, something I was thinking about is how you, in this booklet, you also frame examples of right-wing narratives on climate change. You have, of course, what is commonly understood as the denialist or rejection of climate science. And there's, you give various mm-hmm. examples, you know, climate change doesn't exist, two, it's not caused by humans, or it's natural causes, or it's, you know, too early to tell, CO2 has positive impact on the environment. Right. I've heard that one. Because they can't deny that there's more CO2 now. They're like, well, it's good for the environment. So you're like, all right, that's whatever. Okay. But then there's the skepticism side of it, which is something I see across the spectrum, honestly. And then there's the acceptance, which I guess is especially with really far right groups, there is that ecological component to like fascism, for instance. Right. But something I want to speak, and I'm speaking from where I am in the U.S., particularly when it comes to the right wing and how it frames climate change, is most often it fits more into the denialist camp.
Right.
But one thing I want to highlight, and why I think your booklet here is so important, is that you highlight how we really need to have a social justice framework around climate activism, because the right wing, the more right wing elements of politics, those that are making policies and decisions, like for instance in the US, they're contending with things that are related to climate disruption. So for instance, when it comes to mass migration of people from Central America into the United States, they're not going to say it's because climate change is affecting the ability of these farmers to grow food and all the political crises that come about partly as a result of that. They're not going to frame it that way. They're just going to like say, we need to protect our borders. So what I see is that the right wing can use the denial of climate change as a framework to respond to climate-related trends. Does that make sense? So mm-hmm. I think that's why it's so important to for climate activists to frame it around social justice, because even if there isn't an actual acknowledgement of climate change on behalf of the right wing, they are going to react to it in a very material sense, in real time. So we need to constantly frame it. Like, even if we're not going to discuss it on that level of climate change, we got to say, well, we want to, treat people with dignity and respect, and understand where they're coming from and why they're here. So I think that points to another point you made, which was really interesting, which is that the problem with progressive or leftist or more liberal thinking is we tend to dismiss conservatives as being intellectually inferior because they don't accept climate change or the science of it or whatever. And if you could talk about why that's such a dangerous position to take on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it does a couple of things, right? I think... Overall, it kind of just narrows and takes us out of political engagement. So I think, you know, there might be a number of reasons of why it happens. But if anything, I encourage people to just kind of consider people, rightists in different positions, like actually listen to what they're saying, because very often we assume we know what they want. But there's such a range of kinds of right-wing, rightist groups that our ability to assess the landscape about what is happening becomes quite dull if we assume that they are all the same. So there's like that piece to it too of like, the right is one thing, they all think the same, and they all might be stupid. Granted, these are huge generalizations, but...
Yeah, I would like to follow up well, you can finish your point, but I do want to, if you could explain at some point the difference, because you said we kind of do this thing where we turn them into a monolith, but you were right. Really careful in your writing here to explain there's the extreme right, the radical right, the far right, right. And then there's fascism itself, and they're not necessarily the same thing, and how they manifest in politics. So anyway, if you could get to that point whenever.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll go there now because that's where my brain just jumped to. But
sorry, I think I interrupted your train of thought there.
Just pull it back. No problem.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is also still part of my learning. So it's not as if I came into politics already just knowing this. Why it feels important to me is because I also come from a, you know, I've done a lot of anti-racist political education. That was mostly what I've done before I was in the climate justice movement. Mm-hmm. And I made that transition because I saw so often, time and again, climate groups really not understanding the role of race in how climate solutions are playing out. And so I emphasized wanting to work with majority white groups around racism and anti-racism. But so anyways, coming to this political landscape, we have to hold each other accountable in loving ways to make our analysis more complex, not only to understand that there is not one monolithic right, there are different groups, and some ways that you can orient around that is like, okay, are they like Matthew Lyons, a really lovely historian and writer around far right history in the US and beyond, writes about like, are they loyal to this system or do they want to actually overthrow the system, or are they disloyal? And that's an important distinction. Like, are people trying to align with quote unquote the state? You know, are they trying to support police officers? Are they trying to uphold a certain kind of idea or ideology around nationalism? Or, and are they actually trying to do something quite different? Because those, if you start to assess, like, okay, do they want the current state to continue, yes or no? Because those actually determine what they're organizing and what their messaging really looks like, and then who they might be orienting to bringing in. So these are important features to understand, to feel into. Super, super important to actually read the materials of these groups that we might be up against. So, you know, if there's an organization in your area who's talking about, you know, like pollution and trash pickup, and they happen to be a far right group, it would really be really smart to actually read their materials. Like, yes, take a lot of action and declare what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, but actually to know what these positions might be and what they entail, because sometimes those narratives sound really similar to ours. Right? Like how I got into some of this stuff, I was working with Catalyst Project, an anti-racist collective who does anti-racist political education with different grassroots groups in the US. And we were working with Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. They were turning up anti-racism in all of their campaigns, including their mountaintop removal campaign in Eastern Kentucky. And so they were building these campaigns about like, you know, these are our mountains. We love our mountains. We want to build our economies, you know, healthy communities. This is what we mean. Like, let's get rid of mountaintop removal. This will mean healthy communities. And they were still, of course, working to build in a really strong anti-racist interpretation of what that future could look like. And it wasn't, you know, I got a call kind of in the middle of the night asking for support because their campaign basically was taken by the Traditionalist Worker Party and a couple of other white supremacist groups who took their messaging, took the images of their campaign, organized a rally with much of what they were saying about a just transition. And basically were like, yeah, we also want healthy water. We also want our own economy for white people. So here's another example, right, where environmental campaigns, climate campaigns, talking about the environment, if it's not strongly, strongly and publicly rooted in social justice, in anti-racism in particular, then it's basic. It can be used for white rights, essentially.
Yeah, I think with the sense of urgency that I feel, and I think a lot of people who are aware of these subjects feel right now. There is this idea, as you said there, with the crossing, like that was a traditionalist workers' party, this right-wing party, taking the messaging and the narratives that were from a leftist perspective, and that's not uncommon. I think that's something we need to recognize, is that far-right ideologies and political movements can very easily co-opt narratives from a leftist standpoint. They just sort of refit them to their own ends, to their own purposes. But I think there's this concern that comes up where, all right, we're facing this existential crisis with climate change and the time is now to do something. He's like, well, we've got these right-wing folks over here. At least they understand it's real. At least they understand that we have to do something right now. Maybe we can work with them, and then we'll sort everything out later when, I guess, all the chips fall or something. I don't know how that would work, but, you know, there is that sense. I have heard that from different more radical environmentalists, I would say. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to work out the way you think it will, or even if you do think it will work out in the way that it really would. I mean, that's pretty damn concerning here. So, yeah, I would just like to ask you about that particular thing. Like, there is that temptation from a very, like, pragmatic, like, we got to do what we got to do to fix this problem. But, I mean, what are the dangers in that to you? Not even just contemporarily, but also historically. Because I'm sure there's some historical examples we can draw on here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so many things wrong with that. Let's start with that.
Okay. Yep.
Well, just a caution too, right? Like, part of why this booklet right now is because, right, so many young people are being mobilized with Fridays for Future and Extinction Rebellion, and maybe it's, you know, people coming into a political understanding, but also if there is a lot of passion or commitment to environment at the exclusion of people, labor, lives, livelihood of the people who actually live in the environments or are most impacted by climate crisis, environmental crisis, right? If that's the only thing that matters, then we find ourselves in collusion with people who have ideologies and visions of a world that are racist and xenophobic and lead to some really dangerous ideas. And the problem with more short-term thinking like that, I mean, an important question is like, well, who gets excluded if we win? Like, if we make this coalition, who eventually or now gets excluded? And does that match up with our values? And if you don't have a clear, defined, like, oh, that's not okay, then, or, you know, it's, I think that's an important question for any climate group to be in, to find political alignment around. Because if there's folks in your group or folks in your community who are willing to basically throw other people under the bus, right? Whether that's LGBTQ, whether that's people who are, have migration backgrounds or are immigrants. You know, if we're willing to throw each other under the bus, that's how we actually got here. So those are some of the threats I see, where young people maybe want to background issues like racism and colonization because they are more difficult to contend with, I think. And they would rather foreground climate protections and swift action and healthy future. Like, those things are quite important. But the efforts to make a bigger tent so you can get your campaigns across or get the wins that you want, you know, and especially I think it's more complicated on more local levels around environmental issues, where it can get really localized like that. This is kind of where those coalitions tend to be more prominent, although the recent coalition in Austria was an interesting example where, you know, the Greens replaced the more far right party, but then signed on to their policies that they left over. So it gets really tricky on the bigger scale. But basically, an unwillingness to address root causes of the climate crisis, right? Like, if you're going to really hold on to environmental wins and not account for the racism and the colonization and resource extraction and extractive capitalism that got us here, then you're basically letting go of the climate frame.
Right.
And like you're saying, like green and brown alliances, they have a long history. And whether it's being co-opted, but also, you know, the right borrows from the left, whether it's kinds of organizing or sometimes messaging. But basically what you're then doing is dealing in a politics that is reactionary, that in some form relates to violence and harassment of people in their everyday lives on the street, getting beat up in other kinds of ways, but also playing into the idea that like there are extremes, you know, like more far right groups create political space when they have very quote unquote extreme ideas, which makes more room for conservative other kinds of right-wing groups to then fill in that space to look less extreme. Mm. So then you're starting to deal in those kinds of politics of like a web, basically I call it a web of domination politics. Like you just stepped into a web of domination politics when you do that.
Right. Yeah. And that seems to be the tactic of far right ideologies and groups, is to push the Overton window, push it further and further to the right. So that way, what's may have been considered pretty extreme just a decade ago is now like, oh, that's reasonable. That's moderate. It's more centrist, I guess, you know, like, I don't know. One of the examples is people in the US, you know, Trump is so seemingly so far right that someone like Obama or Bush looks good. And then you see him kind of get put in this framework, are like, they were so much better. And I'm like, they actually laid the groundwork for what Trump is now able to do today. So yeah, I understand what you're saying there. And as far as their effort to shift the political discussion more broadly to the right and creating space there for other right-wing ideas to seep in there. And this morning, you know, before we started, there was about an 8-hour difference, so I guess it was your afternoon or evening, but my morning, waking up to your email, you had written a piece, or you had contributed to a piece, I should say, for Roar magazine. And I just want to quote this little paragraph here from it. You say, my advice to the environmental movement in the U.S. is blunt. Get out of the way of struggles for justice or join unapologetically. If we are not willing to reorganize ourselves, making significant changes to our boards, directors, managers, programs, campaigns, fundraising, development, strategies, yes, all of it, then, well, we are irrelevant. That's really blunt. As you said, you started that saying it was very blunt, but it's like people need to really get on board here and, you know, really take this seriously. Yes. I don't know if you wanted to follow up with anything more on that, because I thought that was beautiful. It was beautiful and it encapsulates it very well. But yeah, if you had anything else to add to that.
Yeah, I think my time in the environmental movement and the climate movement, and of which still feels like absolutely a political home for me, and how I feel like I've come up in seeing what's at stake. I've also seen majority white groups within that movement just really resistant and really committed to staying comfortable and want to be seen in a kind of way of supporting movements for justice. But at the same time, you know, that piece also talks about there's a long history in which we've been anything but supportive. And I love that Sierra Club is like coming around and actually naming and acknowledging harm. That's important. Acknowledging is a great first step. And I know that, you know, there's really amazing people inside these organizations who have been pushing for a long ass time, you know, or are really committed and have been making big steps and changes. And Sierra Club, you know, in particular, there's many other organizations. It's not just Sierra Club, but these are like big boats that take a long time to turn. But at the same time, if there isn't a political will to make that turn on purpose, you're going to be going off, and to continue the boat analogy, you're going to be going off course, you know, like, I feel like COVID and the uprisings in response to the movement for Black Lives and declarations that Black lives do matter. If we are not 100% responsive, right? Like really reorienting where we want to be going as a society, and also just as humans and relating to our own humanness, mm-hmm. Then yeah, we are quite irrelevant. And
I agree with that statement very much. And I do want to point to, I know we have about maybe 10 to 15 minutes before we end this interview, but sure. You had co-authored a book titled No Fascist USA, The John Brown Anti-Klan Committee and Lessons for Today's Movements. And I believe that was published this year.
With City Lights.
City Lights, yeah. And so I read the interview that Shane Burley conducted with you. I believe it's on his Patreon, so I don't know if it's made public. Maybe it's just for supporters, but I really appreciated the interview. And I honestly didn't know anything about this organization, the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee. I really liked how he pulled out of the interview, how you addressed a lot of things that we're kind of talking about right now, which is how, I guess, white folks can really do that difficult work of anti-racism activism and work. Not taking from or co-opting other people's movements, Black people or Indigenous people's activism, or you know, any people of color. Like, it's not like that. It's really just owning up to what white supremacy is, how it operates on a systemic level. Right. And you know, I would just want to ask more about that organization. I don't know much about it. Again, I first heard about it from that interview. And maybe we can apply it to, as we were just discussing before, with kind of owning up to that reality in our climate activism and environmental activism. If you could please talk about that organization a little bit and the history of it.
For sure. Yeah. I think yesterday or the day before too, Shane also wrote a review of the book that's up on Full Stop right now.
Okay.
And actually in August, we're going to do a virtual book tour, making four stops at different local bookstores. So we're going to be in conversation with Shane, with Mark Bray, with Dr. Ed Onasi,
okay.
who wrote Free the Land, who comes from the movements that we talk about in the book. So
okay, cool.
There's a lot more to come.
Virtual book tours are a thing now, I guess.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Not what I dreamed of, but this is what we're doing.
I mean, publishing a book in this time is just changed the whole. Yeah, I get that.
For sure. Yeah.
Anyway.
What made the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee compelling for James and I to study, to research, to interview, to write about was their commitment to movements for self-determination, right? Mm-hmm. So they were a chapter-based network across the country, about 12 cities. They really came from the call for white people to actually take, how it started, there was a very particular moment where after COINTELPRO, most of Black Puerto Rican and Indigenous leaders were mostly incarcerated, if not murdered, or underground.
And this was an FBI program to kind of undermine civil rights and Black liberation groups and other groups, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there was a massive reorganizing about what the political landscape looked like, and for people who are white and who are committed to these liberation movements, you know, that work really shifted from doing anti-racist work in a certain kind of way into doing political prisoner support work. And so what was happening is that a lot of folks were incarcerated. A lot of people in Black Panthers and Black Liberation Army were incarcerated in upstate New York. And what folks on the inside were saying was that, so we are already in our lives surveilled and harassed by the state in that way. And now that we are in prison, we are within this aspect of the system. And there are Ku Klux Klan members who are prison guards. And they're carrying out their own strategies within the prison system, within the state. Mm-hmm. And so this was public knowledge. This was already known, but not a lot was changing. And so the folks on the inside were not only saying what they wanted and needed, of course, around healthcare, of course, around the ability to contact loved ones, of course, around just some of their own basic rights within the prison system, but also the freedom to not be harassed and tortured by Ku Klux Klan members inside the prison, right. If you can call it freedom. And so the John Brand Anti-Klan Committee, the book talks about it. There's lots of different pieces to it, but basically formed in response to the increase of white supremacists and white nationalists, what was then became the white power movement in the 80s, especially under the Reagan administration, right? The signaling that he did and the way that he carved out political space for white vigilantes to organize, to be more public in their racism. And they were, you know, they're an important part of U.S. anti-fascism, you know, movements in the States that were anti-fascist. And what's very important, we think, is that it wasn't just racism and that's where it stopped. Like they were anti-imperialist. They saw empire and the U.S.'s role within a global system of war and genocide. And they were connecting these dots. And sometimes they did it really lovely and well. Sometimes they didn't do it so well. And all of that story, we think, is really important lessons for today, in particular about political repression, right? When the state feels like like it needs to come down hard on movements that are pushing the system, right? What it's willing to do, and then how can we react and respond in our movements to take care of each other? So also a big part of the book is not just about, of course, confronting white nationalists and white supremacists, but also how do we organize ourselves in a way where we can withstand the immense pressure that comes when the state wants your activism to stop.
So this this group, John Brown, they were white folks. Is that correct?
True. Sure.
So it's interesting. Did in their work, there's this whole discussion around white people using their privilege in a systemically racist society as almost like a tool, you know? So you see, like, with these protests, you see, like, we're going to put white bodies in front as a buffer, I guess, or a shield between people of color and black folks and the police, because we know how the police treat people of color in the United States, you know, in a general sense. So in that sense, was it like this organization, were they aware, and were they trying to use, I guess, the privileged position they have in a systemically racist society to their advantage in raising these issues around anti-racism and anti-imperialism and all of these different things?
That was absolutely one part of it, for sure.
Okay.
Of understanding, like, different roles, different access, different ways that we can engage. But I think what is really important is, like, yes, using those different kinds of access as tools, but always within a larger strategy, right? They weren't going off and doing whatever the fuck they wanted to and decided, like, I got a white body, I'm just going to do this thing. But they were rather in rigorous coordination and conversation and kind of always asking, like, what is going to support movements fighting for self-determination right now? What are the demands? How can we organize ourselves and take actions in ways that support that? So I feel like both of those things are quite important. Like, yes, recognize how you are differently socialized, differently placed, you know, come into consciousness around that. Absolutely. And do that within genuine relationships with folks who are on the front lines, and do that within a strategy that, you know, a lot of smart people have been thinking through over time. So it's not one off. It's not just a reaction. And the book chronicles, like, the evolution of this strategy and, like, how people were adapting over time. That's one thing I also appreciate is, like, you know, the organization was around for 13 years and it was pretty under researched or underknown. But I think it's a pretty lovely example of people adapting over time as also the political landscape changes, right? Most of the people, when the organization kind of disintegrated, then also went into work around AIDS organizing and ACT UP. Like, as the political terrain shifted, they carried those politics forward, still with anti-imperialism, still with anti-racism, still with anti-fascism, but always with also a systemic analysis. So never letting go of, like, how power operates across scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess as a final question, we can tie this discussion around climate activism and what you, I'm sorry, I can't remember your co-author's name.
James Tracy.
James Tracy, thank you. And James wrote about in No Fascist USA. What lessons can we draw from that research into the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee and how we can approach climate activism and, you know, some of the lessons that were, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a way to bridge these two things together, and I'm sure you have in your mind that connection. What would that connection be?
One of the most obvious ones to me, and we've kind of been circling it anyways, but I feel like is really worth underlining, is mass coalitions. Building out and organizing, coordinating with organizations who may not share your exact politic, but the ability to have strong relationships across sectors, across regions is really important. And especially the John Brown Anti-Klan Committee came from a milieu and was very consistent in an internationalism that is very much grounded in a kind of proletariat and a kind of movement from the ground up. And that being quite important. And that is still true in this climate booklet about the far right, is like anti-fascism, anti-fascist movements have a bunch of skills that climate activists could learn from, as in like research and understanding how the state works and how different ideas permeate mainstream society, even if, you know, and the consequences of that, like there's different kinds of skills that you gain and learn in anti-fascist movements. And at the same time, both climate and anti-fascist movements have a lot to learn from anti-racist movements.
Right.
Right? Folks at the front line, folks who know exactly how the system is fucked and have, you know, demands and visions of a world where this could actually change and be different. Right. So I tend to think, especially in Europe, like, okay, the climate movement has lots of numbers, has lots of people, lots of interests, increasingly anti-capitalist. That's fantastic. And let's coordinate with the anti-racist struggles here. Let's coordinate with the anti-fascist struggles here. And there's two places that is particularly interesting to me, like the Fridays for Future in Italy. They have declared themselves anti-fascist.
Yeah.
Which hasn't happened in other places. And that comes from working with older activists, and as a youth movement to declare itself anti-fascist, I think is quite important. Or in Dresden, so in Eastern Germany, there's an Antifa group that talks about climate often. And I saw one of their banners recently and it says, burn fascism, not coal. You know, so making these connections across movements, I think is quite important.
Yeah. I think that's super important to make that distinction, or to define climate activism, environmental activism on those lines, because it does create a clear boundary between, you know, more of a progressive or leftist approach, and not being like, we're not going to actually work with any sort of right wing or fascist groups on this. And I think that's extremely important. And as I maybe said earlier, as we're in a state of accelerated crisis in the United States, and, you know, where I'm at particularly, I can feel that, but I imagine this is a global issue, especially around environmental and climate concerns. We have to really educate ourselves and have those tools available to us, and building those coalitions with anti-fascists, anti-racists, and climate activists. I mean, that's, I think if there's a time to do it, it was probably maybe a little too late, but we could do it anyway. I mean, you know, it's important to do that right now. Hillary, I really thank you for the time, for helping me carve out a time to do this. And I would just recommend your really excellent booklet, which is free. You can download it as a PDF. It's really beautifully, it's very beautiful design. Burning Earth, Changing Europe, How the Racist Right Exploits the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And also the book that you co-authored, No Fascist USA, The John Brown Anti-Klan Committee and Lessons for Today's Movements. There's also a book that you had published in 2011, Organizing Cools the Planet, Tools and Reflections to Navigate the Climate Crisis. And also there was that Roar magazine piece that you contributed to, which I will put a link in the description to. Is there anything else you'd like to direct people towards as far as your work goes?
I mean, if people are super interested, they can go to Hillary, HILARYAMOORE, so AMOORE.com.
Okay.
Hillary A. Moore. I have a bunch of links and articles and interviews up there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll be sure to make sure that within the description of this, I'll put all of those links there so people can easily find your work. And okay, cool. Yeah, I really appreciate the time, Hillary. Thank you for agreeing to do this.
Yeah, you're welcome. This was fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, and you can treat that like a bit of a tip jar. If you like this episode, or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would really be helpful. And if you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release, and you will also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As the great psychedelic bard Terence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."